Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Today is the Washington State presidential primary, and your vote is arguably irrelevant unless you're a registered Republican, because the Washington Democratic Party will ignore today's vote. They already had a Democratic caucus months ago. Bernie Sanders won. Republicans will use today's primary results, but only in a strange mashup with caucuses. Have I lost you yet? It's not your fault. Even comedian John Oliver called out Washington for our messed up system.
So, you know your awful friend who says he doesn't vote because he doesn't feel like his vote counts? If he's a Washington Democrat participating in the primary, he's right. He's still awful, but he is right.
John Oliver did the hilarious, maddening 15-minute takedown of America's inane electoral system. So we're tweeting that out to you right now at KUOW. Warning, if you watch it, you may burst into flames. Why can we not elect a president sensibly? Joining us live now are the former head of the Washington State GOP, Kirby Wilbur. Hi, Kirby.
How are you, Bill?
Great, thank you. And the former head of the State Democratic Party, Dwight Pelz. Hi, Dwight.
Hello, Bill.
So, not only do we have caucuses and primaries, we have delegates who don't have to pick the candidate that the voters picked. First of all, Kirby, are John Oliver and I wrong that this is ridiculous?
Well, I think there are a couple of other factors that do play into it, Bill. I think one is the timing of the primary. You know, if the primary was earlier in the year, if it was in March when the caucuses were, there'd be a lot of relevance in the primary in terms of selecting who the president was, at least for the Republicans, because the Republicans allocate their delegates based on how those candidates do in the primary.
Now, if it had happened earlier, then Donald Trump's opponents wouldn't have all dropped out.
Right, exactly. There'd be more people on the ballot, and so it would have been more relevant. For instance, in 2012, we moved the caucuses to March before Super Sunday or Super Tuesday to make them relevant. All the candidates came out to Washington, and we had a record turnout in 2012 because they were relevant. Today, Donald Trump is a presumptive nominee. There's nothing really Republican voters can do in Washington to stop that, so because we're so late in the cycle.
So are you saying, except for the date, you're happy with the system as is?
I think that the giving the choice to the party to determine it's properly in the party's hands. I am more of a caucus believer than a primary believer. I believe in the caucus system, but I think the Republican Party has struck the right balance between caucus and convention. Elect the individual people at the caucuses, but have them allocated based on how the voters vote in May. Unfortunately, I think that's a reasonable compromise.
Okay, we'll talk about votes and subsequent allocations in a moment. But first, I want to hear from Dwight Pelz, from the formerly of the Democratic Party. How do you think we can do this better?
Well, I've come to the painful conclusions that I don't think we should be holding caucuses, and I know I'm probably out of step with a lot of my colleagues in the party. I think it's time to move to a primary. I think it's more democratic. It allows more people to vote, and that's what democracy is all about.
What do your voters, what do Democratic voters actually want? Do you even know?
Well, I mean, Democratic voters, that's what, a million people? No, I don't know what they want. I mean, you'd have to poll them. But, I mean, party activists tend to like the caucuses because party activists like meetings, right? That's why they're party activists.
Right.
And the caucuses can build the party in a year like 08 or 16 where you have a contest between Obama and Hillary, or between Bernie and Hillary, and you get a big turnout, you get a big list from it. But in 2012, you know, we had two people at our precinct caucus. It was utterly embarrassing and really a waste of time and effort by the Democratic Party. So I think that the good years sort of cancel out the bad years, and at the end of the day, the question is, what gets more participation? And it's definitely clear that, you know, more people can participate in a primary than will participate in their caucuses.
Kirby, we know that's true. Way more people vote in primaries than show up at the caucuses like party activists would. So what's so great about the caucus?
Well, I think the caucus system, Bill, I don't think it's too much to ask that people want to partake in this selection process, which is a party selection process. It's not a general public selection process. I don't think it's too much to ask that people give some time to get involved in a caucus system. I like it because for the reasons that Dwight mentions, in presidential election years where there's a contest, It brings people out. It gives you a list of activists. It helps build the party, especially in a state where we don't register by party. This is really the only opportunity the party has to develop a list of names of people who are involved in the party. But I would not be opposed to a primary if they change the primary. It would not. I would not. I don't think it would be a blow. I would hope that we would ask people to pick a party in the primary process. I know Washington voters are very independent, but the selection process really is a party selection process. The primary, the general public gets to speak in November as to who made the right choice for the right candidate. So I think there's a place, a role for the parties to play. And I'm biased toward the caucus, but if we went to a primary, I wouldn't cry.
Okay, no crying in primaries.
No crying in primaries.
Okay.
No crying in politics.
We're talking with the former heads of the state Republican and Democratic parties, and I just want to step back a moment, you know, from the listener's point of view. I mean, we've said already in these last few minutes several times that the parties build mailing lists, and it's the party's process. It's not the general public's process. But isn't that a crazy way to do it? Don't you feel like we're leaving out the voter a lot of times?
Well, first of all, Kirby, you miss a point. A list is created off the primary. When I filled out my ballot for the primary, I had to indicate if I was a Democrat or Republican, and I think that becomes public information. So I do think the party finds out the names of all the people that voted as Democrats in the primary. They just don't get their email address.
And why do I even have to declare a party in the primary time? You know, why is that a good idea?
Well, that's an entirely different discussion about whether political parties are good for American democracy. Kirby and I probably think they are, and you may not think they are. But, you know, strong political parties are good for democracy. And
why are they?
Well, because they give a choice to the voters. They give a contrast to the voters.
You know, basically, a choice of two parties. I mean, many countries give you much more choice than Americans end up getting, right?
Parliamentary system versus a winner-take-all system, which we have. When you have a winner-take-all system, you're always going to end up with only two political parties. But, you know, I once challenged the Seattle Times after they'd been trashing the party forever and ever to cover the election for a year without the reporters using the word Democrat or Republican and see if the reporters or the public could make sense out of the election. And the answer, of course, is no. I mean, people understand politics in America because we use the term Democrat, we use the term Republican, and they have some meaning, and they give people an idea to evaluate their choices.
And we freak out when the parties seem like they're starting to crack up. And what does it even mean? Is Donald Trump a conservative or not a conservative? It's just to the average, you know, someone out of the party system that you guys are in, it does seem, Kirby, understandably strange, right?
I understand that, Bill, and people aren't involved in the process, and party can look at it and say, why does this happen? But I think Dwight raises a very valid point. We are a two-party system, have been since the founding. America's not made, our Constitution, our political tradition is not open to 3, 4, 6, or 10 parties. Those countries tend to have less political stability. I think the two-party system gives us stability. There are two basic views on how government operates, and those parties provide the structure for getting candidates, recruiting candidates, getting messages out to voters. It's how our system works. And the primary, or the caucus, is the party selection process. The members of the party gather together. Here's our best choice for president. Here's our best choice for governor. And then the public has their say in November whether Dwight made the right choice or Kirby made the right choice. The voters have their say in November. But I think as long as you're going to have a party system, the party should be the ones that select their people representing their party. That's why caucuses used to be the same night in March so that Democrats couldn't cross over, Republicans couldn't cross over. You couldn't have that kind of game played.
Washington state taxpayers are paying for this primary $11.5 million. If only a private party, the Republican Party, is using the results, why are state taxpayers paying for it?
Well, I'm sympathetic to the argument, Bill. Actually, I'm sympathetic to the argument that if the selection process limits to the parties should pay for it. In the old days of the caucuses, the parties did pay for it. We only had a primary starting in 1992 as a reaction to the Republican establishment to Pat Robertson winning the caucuses in 88, much as a lot of Democrats are concerned about Bernie having won the caucuses here. So they came up with a primary. It was not the party's choice, either, I think, Democrats or Republicans. Dwight could correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think either of the parties lobbied for the primary. It came about because of Pat Robertson in 88 and then the state has tried to refine the process ever since.
Dwight, we've got 30 seconds for you to react to why should the state taxpayers pay for the primary or otherwise give us your final thoughts.
Well, you know, again, I would like to move away from the caucuses and move to a primary, in which case the state's going to pay for the primary. I mean, ironically, there are states in America that just went from the primary to the caucuses entirely to save the taxpayers' money. So I think elections are valuable. I think the public should pay for them, and I'd like to see the parties get away from the caucuses. And I want to ask Kirby how tall that wall is supposed to be.
Okay, you know, unless you can say it in 10 seconds, we're going to have to leave the wall as a mystery until our next time.
Our next time to get together and talk about it. So.
Let's do that. Let's have a Seattle process. Kirby Wilbur, Dwight Pelz, formerly head of state GOP and Democratic Party, thank you.
You bet. Thanks, Bill.
Primary today, like it or not, it's KUOW's The Record. Thank you for tuning in to KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. If we change an old racist name of a Washington State lake, are we erasing history? Is that a bad thing? A public radio inventory finds more than 200 Northwest places with names some people might consider ethnically or racially offensive. There's Negro Bend Mountain in southwest Oregon, Chinaman's Hat in western Idaho, Jew Valley in southern Oregon, and Redman Creek or Redman Creek in north central Washington. A geographic names board in Oregon has already been working on changing place names that begin with squaw. Now Washington State is scrubbing place names. And correspondent Tom Bonsi reports some residents do not think it's right to erase part of history.
By far, the most common, potentially insensitive place name we found is Squaw.
It's a generally offensive name for Native people. To me, it's not an appropriate name.
Mike Isle is a Cowlitz Tribal Councilman and member of the Washington State Committee on Geographic Names.
It doesn't have to be that everyone's offended, but if it is known to be offensive to some, that should be reason enough to change it.
Oregon tribes and government agencies have been laboring for well over a decade to change the names of the many squaw, creeks, flats, buttes, meadows, and springs in Oregon. Now Washington State is getting proactive. Washington State Senator Pramila Jayapal convinced the State Department of Natural Resources to inventory objectionable place names. The agency found 36 names, and the senator's office published the list. It includes Jim Crow Point, Jim Crow Creek, and Jim Crow Hill in Wakayakum County along the lower Columbia River. At first, the locals did not appreciate politicos from Seattle and Olympia telling them what's best, according to Joe Budnick of Kathlamet, the county seat.
The inference that we were racist and that we were stupid and didn't know that we were offending people and all this other stuff, when we're not.
By Budnick's telling, Jim Crow Point and Creek were named after an Indian chief. Another source says the name comes from crows that nested in trees on the riverbank. Yet others suspect the name was a demeaning reference to a 19th century African-American Navy deserter who settled in the area. Whatever the true origin, Budnick took the initiative to suggest replacement names, which quickly found support at a geographic names committee meeting where I met him.
I just wanted to get it over with because the papers have just been telling us how stupid we are and how we need to be educated.
Another targeted name is Squaw Bay in Washington's San Juan Islands. A number of islanders have spoken up or written letters in favor of a name change for the small cove. Others want to keep the name the way it is. A consistent thread through the preservationist comments is don't succumb to political correctness and don't wipe away our history. John Shannon lives on Shaw Island.
I would never call someone a squaw. But there's a difference between making it personal and the history that goes along with the place names that have been assigned, you know, historically. And I guess I just don't see anything wrong with that.
In Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, the gatekeepers for geographic name changes are volunteer committees that meet about twice a year. Kyle Blum of the Washington Department of Natural Resources says usually those boards only consider changes when they're brought forward by the public.
Our traditional model has been to wait and respond to proposals when we get them. Our goal in working with Senator Jayapal on the initiative has been to actually go out and inform people. Did you know this name exists in your area? Did you know there's a process by which it can change?
Blum's agency is trying to line up public meetings in communities to move the cumbersome name change process along. The first one is planned in King County, home to a Coon Creek. In that case and others, it's unclear if the name was given as a racial slur or if it's a reference to raccoons. A Coon Creek or bay named after the animal might just keep its name. I'm Tom Bonsi in Olympia.
And we've posted an interactive map where you can see Coon Creek and other places near you that may or may not have a derogatory name. You'll find that at our website, KUOW.org, under the headline, What's in a Name? It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. When Lindy West was a kid, she was so shy, she only talked to her parents. And even then, it was mostly in whispers. It's a big difference compared to who she's known as now, an outspoken advocate for women and fat people. Her new book is even called Shrill, Notes from a Loud Woman. Lindy West told Jeannie Yandel she did a lot of thinking about what being fat meant to her.
For my whole life, I believed that I wasn't going to be fat forever because I was going to fix it. And then once I fixed it, then my life could start. And so at some point in my late 20s, I was like, what am I waiting for? Like, what, you know, I started to finally have the courage to confront the question of what if I never become thin? What if I never succeed at this thing? Which I so far haven't, you know, and I had spent my whole life dieting and going to aerobics and whatever. And it hadn't really done much for me except give me a horribly toxic relationship with food, which I would say pretty much every woman I know has. So I started to think about that in a critical way. And I realized that I had been waiting. I'd been waiting to really fully engage in my life because I felt like I wasn't me yet, because that's what they sell you. That's how the diet industry works. Like, when you pay enough money for our services and you stop being lazy and you finally become the real you, then you can have all the stuff you want. You can, you know, fall in love and be successful. And I really bought into that. And then at a certain point, I started dismantling it in my head and I was just done.
I feel like that's the moment that at least anybody in Seattle who reads The Stranger found themselves part of your own realization process. You called your boss at the time out. You called Dan Savage out for the way he wrote about fat people. And you said, this is not okay. Why did you decide to do that?
Well, I mean, I think it's, especially at the time, it was really easy to talk about fat people like an abstraction, like a economic and political problem to be solved, and to pretend like there weren't fat people around you in your life and working in your office with you and being your friend and sitting in your living room and having coffee. And you know what I mean? Like it was this politicized conversation where it was totally acceptable to say we need to eradicate fat people as though there weren't fat people listening who are people who are in control and in charge of their own lives. I mean, the way that Dan was writing about fat people at the time was totally normal. I don't mean to even say that he was, you know, being a horrible, hateful bigot, because it was normal. That was the way the discourse was going. It was like, obesity epidemic, what are we going to do? Fat people, you know, we need to stop coddling fat people and we need to start telling it like it is and eat less, exercise more, blah, blah, blah. That was fashionable and normal. So, I mean, I'm not even trying to condemn Dan in particular, but having it actually published in my workplace eventually became really demoralizing and difficult. And so after a couple of attempts to talk to him about it privately, I was like, well, here's how we usually handle things here at The Stranger is we put it on Slog. We talk about these things in a really direct way and in a public way that people can participate in and in a performative way. I mean, it's a really performative paper. That's part of the ethos of the paper, is we do these sort of big, wacky stunts to make a point. So, yeah, so I wrote this long sort of manifesto and put it on Slog.
The title of which was, I remember reading it really well. You titled it, Hello, I Am Fat.
Yes.
So it wasn't just about what Dan was saying. It was also, it was about you.
It was mostly about me. You know, Dan happened to be the catalyst, but it wasn't really about Dan. It was about everyone who was engaging in this discourse about fatness and the obesity epidemic and, you know, my insurance premiums and whatever. But yeah, it was really about me and where I was in my life and deciding that I wasn't going to be part of this system anymore and let it control my life. So it was this big declaration. And I thought of it even at the time as like a coming out process, because when you believe that you're just a broken thin person, you don't self-identify as fat. And if you don't self-identify as fat, how do you advocate for yourself and ask people to treat fat people better? Because you don't think of yourself as a fat person, so why should you care? You know, it's like you have to come to terms with the fact that at least, and like, things can change. My body may still change. I'm sure it will. I mean, bodies change all the time. But I am a fat person right now in this moment, and I don't want to live in an imaginary future anymore. You know, I want to live in the present.
You recognize it as a coming out moment. At the time that you wrote it, you said you kind of knew that's what it was like. But it's one thing to write the words and it's another thing to publish them. What was it like to hit publish? What was that moment like when you were like, okay, everybody, here it is?
It was terrifying and it was so satisfying and liberating. Reclaiming terms is so powerful. I mean, if I've written a whole article acknowledging that I'm fat, what can you do to me? I mean, because at the time I was getting comments all the time that just said, you're fat. Like, okay, yeah. So now what? Good luck hurting me with that thing that I already acknowledged, you know, that I already declared and declared without shame. So yeah, it felt great. I mean, it was really stressful at work, you know, and Dan, there was a lot of drama, and Dan and I had to, you know, have a peace summit and whatever. And it was fine. And we're on great terms now, although I don't know that he's read the book yet, but I hope he's not mad at me. And it all ended up working out beautifully. I mean, I think that Dan listened to me and took at least some of what I said to heart. And I think that you can see in his writing that he writes about fat people differently now. And I'm really tremendously grateful to him for that and impressed. It's really hard to listen and hear people and internalize what they're saying and change your thoughts and behaviors. So I really appreciate that. And it's weird, but I didn't know this was going to happen at the time, but looking back, I realized that I had been waiting for my life to start, that I needed to lose weight for my life to start, and then I rejected that in this really public way. And it's like, starting from there, that week I went on my first date with my now husband, my career has really exploded in ways that I never anticipated. Starting there, like, I mean, and obviously there were other things in motion, set in motion before that, but I don't want to sort of engage in this magical thinking, like, because it can't be prescriptive, like, oh, just tell everyone you're fat and then you'll get to marry a cool guy and, you know, like, get a book deal or whatever, because that's ridiculous. But I think just in terms of, it was a product of where I was in my life, and it really was true for me that I was holding myself back, and I needed to stop doing that in order to live the life that I wanted and that I was capable of. So, yeah, that was a hugely transformative moment, and I'm grateful to Dan for that, honestly. So don't be mad at me. I love you.
Seattle's own Lindy West. Her new book is Shrill, Notes from a Loud Woman. Tomorrow, you'll hear why Lindy West decided to publicly confront people online who say insulting things about fat people and about her. And she's going to be talking about her book tomorrow night at Town Hall Seattle. Again, tomorrow night, 7:30. KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. How do you get thousands of homeless people into shelter? One idea, send them someplace else to find it. They're trying this out in Portland. One-way bus or train tickets for homeless people who want to leave the city. Susan Salisbury is with the Portland group 211 Info. They're running this pilot. She says it isn't just a one-way ticket out of town. It's help for people who have a better situation somewhere else and no way to get there. But in Seattle, Sarah Rankin with the Homeless Rights Advocacy Project at Seattle University is not so sure.
I'm skeptical because we have seen jurisdictions where this sort of approach is perceived of as a primary response. But two, it also supports sort of the myth of migration, that people are actually being bused in from other jurisdictions. And we hear this all the time. Every city that we talk to says and suspects that their particular crisis of homelessness is the result of some other city piping their own poor populations into other jurisdictions. And that sort of narrative is used as a scare tactic to discourage investment in addressing the problems of those particular populations. So there's more than one way that this sort of project can end up having a negative impact. I think what Portland can do to make sure that this sort of limited project actually results in a good outcome is to design and implement an evaluation program from the very beginning of its inception that will show that that intervention is successful in terms of leaving that individual better off than they would have been without the intervention.
Susan, do you have those kind of that ability to make sure the people you give a bus ticket to end up better off?
Yes, one of the requirements that's been built into the program from the beginning is both a verification before the person travels. They're required to have a firm contact, and that contact party is contacted and screened to make sure that there is a stable situation there, that the person is, you know, going to be met, physically met when they arrive. And there also is a 90-day follow-up to make sure, to check in and see how things are going. And through 211's network of information and referral agencies around the country, we can also make sure that if there are additional resources that they need in that location, that we can make sure that they get hooked up with resources where they are. And before this pilot program, and this is a pilot, only going through June 30th, so we definitely want to evaluate carefully what the outcomes are. We did talk to programs around the country that have implemented similar transportation kinds of programs. And one of the things that we specifically asked about was, how is this perceived by both people participating in the program and by the general public? Because I agree that public perception of these programs can sort of drive us off in the wrong direction. So we don't want to set up a program that's going to encourage just shipping people out. That's not at all what this is about. We simply want to help people who really are highly motivated to get to where they want to go. They have a place that's going to work for them. And with that follow-up, to see how things are going for them.
Sarah, it sounds like this is about helping people.
I don't think there's any grounds to question the good intentions. Let me just distinguish this from some other instances, some very isolated instances that I'm aware of, where the work has not been undertaken by the city, but instead has been undertaken by social workers and members of the faith community who have very deep, long-standing relationships with the individuals who are being served. And they, in those instances, don't just confirm with those locations or follow up after 90 days. They maintain a relationship, a meaningful relationship with those individuals. And it's clear in those relationships that if that individual has any sort of failure or things fall through in their new location, that they are welcome to return and that support exists back in the originating jurisdiction. And so part of the skepticism comes from a concern that without that sort of open door of return back and we will continue to help you, you run the risk of it being a campaign of displacement instead of one that is and remains focused on the well-being of the individual.
What's your response, Susan?
This is a program that's developed as a consortium of 9 other homeless services programs. And if a program in Portland is already working with a family or an individual, they know them well, and if it ends up that really this family or this individual really wants to be somewhere else, they need to be somewhere else, then we want to facilitate that. And the agencies that are participating have been working with folks for a long, long time, some of them. And so we're not just going to simply cut ties with people that we're serving through this program. We are well equipped to offer additional resources and support to folks through 211 to refer them to other support systems in their current location. The program doesn't have a round trip built into it, but through our own networks of resources, we would offer additional support, check in with the person. There's a considerable amount of support available for people to call for additional services.
What do each of you think of the theory that a city that helps homeless people too much is a city that attracts homeless people? Susan?
I don't think there's anything attractive about being homeless. I think that it's not something that anyone would wish for. And I don't think that there's any action on the part of any authority or jurisdiction that would encourage that. And I think that there's an aspect here of basic human compassion, which we believe in here at 211 Info. And I don't think that there's any, it doesn't serve anyone to encourage homelessness in any way. And it's I don't believe it's a choice that anyone would intentionally make given a level playing field.
Sarah?
I think the two issues really need to be severed because the program that Portland is undertaking that Susan's been talking about is one that is, if it's done well and if it meets its goals, is really supposed to be reconnecting people experiencing homelessness with robust support that will lift them out of homelessness. And that, when I say robust support, I mean family, friends, not services, not another shelter in some other place. When we hear about the myth of migration, that's that sort of myth that other people are coming in hordes from other places to chase services. And we see this as really a scare tactic to discourage that sort of investment. And we also, this sort of narrative frequently dehumanizes people and frames them as something like a virus or a rash that spreads. We've seen instances where this sort of myth is equates human beings to animals. You know, sort of a don't feed the pigeons mentality. We have seen no data to support the suggestion that the provision of more accessible and meaningful services results in an increase in the homeless population in that area.
Sarah, you've talked about a way to keep people rooted where they are, help people where they are. What do you mean by that?
Well, the web of laws and policies that cities often have in place result literally in the purging of visibly poor people from public space and the moving of people to the literal fringes of society. So this is a really recurring issue that we see across the nation. And so that's why, you know, projects like the busing project, if it doesn't have a round trip, it will provoke concern that it would be a feeding into a possible campaign of displacement or something that could be one city's washing their hands of needing to further support their own residents. What we'd really, really like to see is a change in those sorts of laws so that homelessness is really recognized as part of the shared problem of a particular community and to keep people where they are so that we can work at this in a compassionate and integrated way.
Keep people where they are. What's your comment on that, Susan?
Well, I just want to emphasize that this is just one part of a much larger effort here in Portland. This is a program that's developed as a consortium. These are all folks that work daily, hands-on, with people providing services getting them housed, working with people to establish themselves within the community here in Portland. All of them are members of this consortium with no intent to disestablish people from this community and send them off elsewhere. We're only working with people who are motivated to go, who want to be somewhere else, and who need to be somewhere else. No one is interested in sending someone off with no services and no supports.
Susan Salisbury is with 211 Info in Portland, and they're running this pilot program that helps homeless people leave Portland if they have somewhere stable to go. You also heard from Sarah Rankin, who runs the Homeless Rights Advocacy Project at Seattle University. She wants to see us helping homeless people where they are. Now, Seattle's service providers offer a similar program to the one in Portland. A homeless person here can get bus, train, sometimes plane tickets if they have a place to stay or a job lined up somewhere else in the country. We'll continue to cover issues around homelessness here on KUOW Seattle. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Welcome to the lunch hour, when food really matters. I'm one of those people who often skips breakfast, and I just read that people like us, we're okay. In a New York Times op-ed, a pediatrician poo-poos the studies that call breakfast vital to your health. He says those studies are either funded by Kellogg's or Quaker Oats, or they're just shoddy science. Now, if you did skip your morning meal along with me, you probably are due for nourishment. So please turn up the radio now so that you can hear us over your chewing. Now, on with the news. Marijuana is legal and it sucks power. By which I mean pot cultivation is estimated to use 1% of America's electricity output. That's enough juice to power 1.7 million average homes. And as more states legalize, the power consumption is expected to grow. Northwest Energy officials project cannabis grows will suck up 3% of the region's power by 2035. As Jefferson Public Radio's Leah Moriarty reports, efforts are underway to get growers to reduce their energy use.
John Kaguya cuts right to the chase.
Indoor cannabis cultivation is extraordinarily energy intensive.
Kaguya is director of industry analytics for New Frontier, a Washington, D.C.-based cannabis industry consulting firm. For example, he says,
for every kilo of marijuana produced, the energy footprint equates to 4.3 tons of carbon dioxide and the equivalent of 7 cross-country trips in a car that is getting 44 miles per gallon.
Kaguya recently authored a study that details the growing power consumption of cannabis grows and lays out the risks it poses, not only to the power grid and the environment, but to marijuana businesses themselves. Faced with a burgeoning legal marketplace, growers are facing vigorous competition, leading to tighter profit margins.
As the price of cannabis falls, energy use becomes a growing part of their operational cost, and growers who are focused on energy efficiency are increasingly gaining a competitive advantage.
Colt Hansen owns Grow City, a store in Medford that sells indoor growing equipment. He says the metal halide and high-pressure sodium lights that have long been the favorites of indoor cannabis growers are starting to yield to fluorescence and other energy-efficient technologies.
In our store, we've seen a large increase in T5 lighting fixtures from what I'm used to, and the LEDs we've been bringing in are selling out as fast as I can bring them in.
Even so, Hansen says many longtime growers tend to be set in their ways and are reluctant to change what's been a winning formula.
It's like your grandma's got that recipe for that perfect batch of cookies. You don't go changing their recipe at all. And so most of these people have learned this rule of thumb for themselves, and veering away from that is just unheard of.
As a grower himself, Hansen says it's more than just habit that makes many growers reluctant to embrace new lighting technologies.
You got to understand that these experiments cost these guys thousands of dollars in power and air conditioning and food and nutrients. And so if it goes bad, it's affecting either a patient's medicine or their business.
Adam Bartini with the Energy Trust of Oregon gets that concern.
We can know with fairly good certainty whether a particular lighting fixture is going to save energy. I guess the question is how well it's going to grow cannabis and how happy that particular grower is going to be with the product.
The Energy Trust has been working for years with homeowners, businesses, and industries to help them cut their energy use. And Bartini says the rapidly expanding cannabis industry is showing interest in the trust's services.
We've completed or have in our project pipeline about 23 projects at this point. Interest is definitely picking up.
The Energy Trust offers free technical assistance to identify ways to reduce power use.
We can have an energy efficiency engineer go out to the site. They scope out the different opportunities, and we can produce a technical study for that customer.
The trust can also offer cash incentives that can cover up to half the upfront capital cost of installing efficient lighting and other energy-saving equipment. The New Frontier study says using more efficient lights is an improvement, but growing cannabis in greenhouses or outdoors using free sunlight is even better, reducing electricity costs by up to 90%. Peter Gross, with the Green Valley Wellness Dispensary in Talent, says he's grown both indoors and outdoors. And while each has its pros and cons, given the ideal growing climate in Southern Oregon and Northern California, outdoors makes a lot of sense.
You just get like much bigger plants with much less energy consumption.
Among the recommendations offered by the New Frontier Report are more research on new energy efficient lighting technologies, as well as changing rules in some jurisdictions that discourage or even ban outdoor grows. If the cannabis industry is to thrive, it concludes, growers will have to make energy conservation a top priority. I'm Liam Moriarty reporting.
You're grooving with the record here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks to LeBron James and Kobe Bryant, it's not news when a talented high schooler skips college and heads straight to the NBA. But it was not always like that. Until 1971, the NBA had a four-year rule. Players had to wait 4 years after graduating high school before they could play pro ball. Then a Seattle Supersonic went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court to challenge the NBA for the right to go pro straight out of high school.
In 1970, my mother was still picking cotton in Silver City, Mississippi for $2 a day, 12 hours a day, with a 100-pound sack. Her back had went out because that's all she has done since she was 3 years old. And so I was trying to get my mother out of the cotton field, so that's how the whole case started.
That is former Seattle Supersonic Spencer Haywood. The team's owner, Sam Shulman, ignored the NBA's four-year rule and signed Haywood to the team. Haywood challenged the NBA for the right to play, and his Supreme Court victory paved the way for generations of NBA stars to turn pro straight out of high school. Spencer Haywood told me that his court fight got nasty.
Well, I could not have challenged that case any other city because Seattle was a nurturing place. It cared for me. The people cared for me, and they loved me. And I don't care what was being printed out at that time. The Seattle people just lived and died with them, some Spencer Haywood in this case. So
you don't think that was just you being a hometown sports hero? There was something different about Seattle than the rest of the racially torn-up country?
No, Seattle was just totally different. And I had came up from Mississippi to Detroit, and I went to high school there. Seattle was just this, it still is to me, this place that you have harmony of all races of people, and it's a good place to raise your children. And here I am, a young man of 20 years old, being raised by this great city and surrounded by water. I'll tell you a story. When I came in from my first visit to Seattle, this is the first time I've ever seen Seattle, and I saw it from above, and I said, this is a postcard. I wonder if the people will be that great on the ground. And so when we got on the ground, the press conference came about, and one of the press contingency says to me, oh, you're going to love it up here. You're 20 years old. You're going to have a lot of young women up here for you. And I said, but I haven't seen any black women. He says, no, it's not like that here, sir. So there was the answer that I was like, oh, okay, yeah, thank you.
You mentioned that Seattle wrapped its arms around you. Is there another story you can think of that really hits you about your time in Seattle?
Well, yeah. Well, when I would come in from the case, I hadn't taken an apartment or nothing, so I stayed in the Westin Hotel there. And when I would just go up into the room, and I would just be crying and crying and crying, and I had room service come, and the room service gentleman told me, said, wait a minute, you know, you're doing something so significant. Keep your head up. Don't cry. Don't feel the pain. We will get you through it. And I always felt that way about Seattle, that you would get me through. So I learned a lot about people at that time.
I want to make sure I understand. What were you crying about that day in Seattle?
I mean, the pain of going through this, man, when people throwing bottles at you on the court and hitting you, and then you have a team. I come out of the locker room and walk out on the floor, and they stand in protest and walk off the floor and left me up there all alone to take all of that brutal beating. And my teammates, we were like, is this some madness or what?
Why were they so upset about your court case?
Well, because, you know, you had all of those people were affiliated with certain universities, and the university system had deemed me the devil, and that's how they portrayed me. And they would hit me in my stomach and hope that I would fight back. And, oh, it was so brutal.
We're talking with former NBA star Spencer Haywood, former Seattle Supersonic. Since you won that Supreme Court case, we now have great players going to the NBA right from high school, as you know. But that also means that middle school kids are living as if they might be in the NBA in 3 years. How healthy is that for these kids?
Not healthy. I understand that players should be thinking of the NBA or thinking of professional. But I think it was maybe 10 years ago, we had the first six picks were out of high school, and not one of them made it. I saw that was a tragedy. Guys who are 19 years old who can play but can't really play because their bodies haven't developed. So when they get on the floor, they hurt. And also, when you go into the locker room, you see that the oldest player is maybe 24, and there is no balance in the locker room. You have no veteran in there talking about, well, these are the things you got to do.
How do you feel about paving such a dangerous road for kids less skilled than you were who might fail and not be ready to handle that failure?
I think it can be rectified if the NCAA, the NBA, and the Players Union come together with some kind of understanding that we need to do something about this. And then also, the NCAA is going to have to look at making players who play in these high octanes universities and sports system that they might be state employees or university employees. So it means that you have to pay some of that $1.6 billion to the players, or you have to develop an insurance policy that covers those players, the football players as well, because the NFL uses the Spencer Haywood rule as well.
Yeah, you mentioned football. We've been seeing here with Bellevue High School football, best high school program in Washington State, coaches are now accused of having athletes take classes at a private school in a strip mall so they can be eligible to play at Bellevue High. How uncomfortable are you with high school's focus on pro sports?
Well, that is the time we live in because it is a job. It is a business. You know, the student athlete was the design of some great guy back in 1956. We will never call them just athletes. They'll be student athletes. So the student part of it is a little wishy-washy, and because it is a business. And we don't want to look at that as a business, you know?
Right. We want something more pure.
I know. We love that purity.
We love the idea of it.
That's where my problem came in. I was doing the unpure thing. I was leaving college. Oh, my gosh. And I remember Thurgood Marshall, who heard my case at the Supreme Court. He said, son, you're going to be ostracized for years to come. And I looked at him like he was like, what is this old man talking about? Is he crazy? They going to love me. The players are going to, like, say, ooh, what a savior. Because a guy like LeBron and Steph Curry, man, he helped me earn $100 million more for 4 extra years. I'm going to love this guy. And lo and behold, I have no idea who I am. And when they mentioned my name, they're like, he was a troublemaker. And I'm like, yeah, right. This movie bringing history to life for the Seattle people in Seattle so they'll know to fight for getting a team in Seattle, because you are the history of the NBA. And we still arguing on whether we should have a team. Lord sakes. I mean, come on, city council, come on.
You heard about that, huh?
Yeah, it's scary to me. Like, what are you doing? Guys, I'm saying this to all of us in Seattle. Step up.
How are you stepping up? Gary Payton says he wants to be a part owner of the Seattle Sonics. What about you and him and Sean Kemp and Jack Sikma and Lenny Wilkins and Detlef Schrempf? Dream team.
That's a dream team, isn't it? Yeah.
Would you want to get involved in a Sonics team?
I went out of my way and called Chris Hansen and said, look, you guys can't leave me out of this deal now. You have to come to the original source, and I am the original source. So now we all are getting on the same page to make it happen. We cannot play around anymore. We can't be so analytical, you know, because you know how we are in Seattle. I mean, we have the best educated people in America, and everything becomes so analytical.
Processy?
Yeah, there you go, that word. So we don't do, like, you know, well, hey, we got to have a team back. Let's do it. Here. Oh, no, let's study it. Let's put it on the board, make sure it's just right. You know, please. So this movie gives you the opportunity to see what the battle was, who you are in history of NBA basketball. You know, my jersey is sitting over there in mothballs, too, which was hanging in the old arena there. Mm-hmm. So we would love to have all that back. But if you don't get the name, we need a team there immediately. And I know people have said to me on the down low, like, you know, Memphis and everyone else, God, I would sure like to move to Seattle. Everybody wants to move to Seattle, you know. So we have to move on Seattle. And we all need to unify and come together with this great idea of bringing our treasures home to Seattle.
Sounding confident about a Supersonics return to Seattle or environs, that is former All-Star Spencer Haywood. Supersonics legend of the early and mid-1970s, when my 7-year-old self would run up and down my hallway pretending there were two baskets when really there was only one over the laundry room door, and I would pretend to be the greatest players in the NBA, including Spencer Haywood and Jack Sikma and downtown Freddie Brown. The story of Spencer Haywood's U.S. Supreme Court fight to challenge the NBA's 4-year rule is called Full Court, and it just had its premiere at the Seattle International Film Festival. We're sharing a link to the trailer with you right now on Twitter at KUOW.